We're really excited with this week's podcast. Today we have Lieutenant Governor Scott Bedke, a longtime friend and all around just great human and just one of the quintessential Idahoans. He is a rancher from Oakley, Idaho. He was elected as Idaho's 44th Lieutenant Governor in November of 22. He represents District 27 in the Idaho House of Representatives and was the Speaker of the House for 10 years. Which was the longest term of a Speaker of the House ever in Idaho history. Spent a lot of time there in leadership and really understands Idaho. Lieutenant Governor Bedke has spent his entire life in ranching and then in service in politics and has been recognized in 2015 as one of the top influential Idahoans. We're really happy to have him, and I think you'll really enjoy getting to know him better and hearing what he has to say about this legislative session and the future of Idaho. Lieutenant Governor Scott Bedke is joining us today. Scott, how you doing?
Very well. Very well.
We're just talking water.
We are.
Let's start there. You were just telling me about Island Park.
Well, I watched that pretty close.
Yeah.
And the measurements that were taken on the first day of February every year for the last however 50 years, the lowest year on record was the water year of 2000-2001. And this year we're tied with the lowest water year on record. At this point, now there's a lot of winter, hopefully,
you know,
farmers are eternally optimistic. We got our fingers crossed and everything, but it's you know, the good news is that we have some carryover in the reservoir system.
Yeah.
But the mountains.
Snowpack is
not there.
I've never, you know, in McCall where we go as of last weekend and where we're usually wondering, do we need to shovel the roofs?
Yeah.
There's like 2 inches on the roof.
Yeah.
It's like end of March, April.
Well, then, but south of the Snake River, down in where we ran.
The Owyhees?
Yeah, that's all above normal.
Yeah.
So.
Hey, well, thanks for coming on. This has been fun. We rebooted this and have a lot of people to listen. And you were on our
Well, I'll have to subscribe myself.
Oh, yeah, you should.
I did.
We had Bobby Joe on last time, and she talked a little bit about Butch and Brad. It was good. Yeah. And then... We've had a good run. Hey, so I'm just a little bit about you, just because we'll have a formal bio when we start this. But Speaker of House for 10 terms.
10 years. 5 terms.
5 terms, 10 years. You were the longest speaker.
Yeah, longest serving speaker in state history.
Which is a big deal.
Well, it's a big deal, but it's a huge honor because you're elected by your peers.
Yeah.
And so... I am honored that they trusted me enough to wield the power of the speakership because it's formidable.
Yeah.
And they trusted, not that we always agreed, but they trusted me to enough to elect me five times in a row.
And now Lieutenant Governor.
Yeah.
I was thinking, I saw Brad went down to the border.
Yeah.
And the first thing I thought, you know, I thought, I'll bet that guy is so happy that you're his guy instead of Janice now.
Well, that's what I told him. Well, his first trip after, at the first of the year, I said, hey, don't worry. Everything will be right where you left it. And, you know, the good thing about that is he's been able to go and interact out of state with the other governors and whatnot and not have to look over his shoulder, not worry for 1 second. The people of Idaho haven't even noticed really that he's been gone.
And it was a story every time. What was she going to do? And he left. And anyway.
Well, and that's jerking the citizens of Idaho around.
Yeah.
That's not what our job is.
It was all political theater is what it was. And it was, anyway, hey, I know you well, but, when you were running for Lieutenant Governor and you had been the speaker for so long and I knew you so well, I was surprised in Idaho.
Yeah.
It's a big state. Just how many regular Joes, business people like Scott, who?
Yeah.
And I think you're a lot more well-known now that you're the in the role you're in. But tell us a little bit about you growing up. And I've been able to, I've had the honor of being at a Bedke branding.
Yeah.
So Oakley.
Right. So my great-grandfather came over from Prussia in 1860. Came to New York, long story short, sails around the Horn to San Francisco, comes in, you know, and we have his citizenship papers that he got in 1863 during the Civil War in New Orleans on the way around. And then we know that he came into Idaho, but also he followed mineral strikes inland and into Idaho, into Park City, Utah, into Montana. And on one of those trips, he must have made a mental note about that little valley east of Oakley, the basin east of Oakley. And he came and overwintered there for the first time in 1878. And he had, as the story goes, he had 98 head of cows, and the rest is history. So I'm the fourth generation on the family cattle operation. Now, there hasn't been continuity from his operation to mine, but I ranch in the exact same area that my great-grandfather did. I have the fifth and sixth generations are at home. I'm able to do all this because my son and my nephew are back at the ranch. So my brother and I are together, and then both of our sons are there. And they all have kids as well. So that's kind of where we come from.
Like the one thing about when I was able to travel around the state and really, really see all of it, I think because of where Oakley sits, there may not be people that really are aware of just how special that valley is and how incredible it is. And then you start meeting people. There are a lot of people, great Idahoans from there. There's a heritage there that is deep and rich. Talk a little bit about that area of the state.
Well, if you were coming into Idaho before any of the major irrigation projects, and you just had to live off the land and be sustainable in an area, Oakley, that little finger of the valley off of Magic Valley, is, you know, because you have Birch Creek coming down the one draw, Goose Creek coming down the other, Cottonwood, and it's just a great place to go and live.
Yeah.
Now we have the Oakley Reservoir and the reservoir systems on the Snake. And so the farming now has come in, and it connects the Oakley area with the Snake River, with the Burley area. And it's all farm ground now. And it's just one of the very good, the soil is great. And as long as you got water, you can really raise.
So historically, it was water and then soil, and it is one of the best places in Idaho for farming, right? So
yeah,
big,
really,
large,
really
farms.
Prosperous farms there, and the South Hills have great grass. I mean, so we're out there where Idaho, Utah, and Nevada make the tea. So Goose Creek starts in Idaho, goes south into Nevada, turns east, comes through the very corner of Utah, and then turns north and comes back into Idaho, and they catch that big drainage in the Oakley Reservoir. And that's our irrigation water for the south end of the Oakley Valley. And then again, it hooks up with the river as we pump water south.
Tell us the story of the canal that was built in, like, I'm gonna miss this. I read the book.
1984,
and they build a canal in like record time. I read the book, but I can't remember exactly how long it was.
Well, it was a year not like this year, in that there was like 200% of normal of snow in the South Hills. Now, and that drains a lot of country there. In fact, when they first planned the Oakley Reservoir, if you look on the maps, it's called the Lower Goose Creek Reservoir because it drained enough country to have an Upper Goose Creek Reservoir. There were two planned, but it never did really materialize. And, you know, the water did never materialize, or it never did fill the lower one, frankly. But that year, it was a huge winter year. And we started, I remember distinctly, because I just got out of college a couple of years and was back at the ranch. And the cattle were on full feed on November 14th, but they should have been on November 12th, but we just couldn't get there for the snow. It dumped. We had like 2.5 feet of snow everywhere and more down in Nevada and that Nevada corner drains back up into Idaho. And so, so we had this huge water year, and when it ran off in the late April and 1st of May, it was, you know, it was going to fill and overtop the reservoir. And so we hurried and raised the top of the reservoir another 4 feet to buy time, to get to dig a canal basically to the Snake River. And they did that. I mean, the whole valley just dropped everything and dug that canal to the Snake River. And they did it in less than a week.
Yeah.
Actually, it's, I think 4 or 5 days.
It's like an, it's like this incredible story of of neighbors helping neighbors, everyone dropping everything and doing something that you would never dream possible.
Right. They let school out. Kids were sandbagging and, but we were on, but then when they let the water out, you then you had to patrol it to make sure it didn't wash or didn't break out. And so, you know, we had schedules and all night long. Of course the kids loved that, but we were, there was always adult supervision, but anyway, and I was a young adult at that point. And then 10 days later it was over. You could ride a canoe.
We got some, Maddie pulled up some pictures here.
Yeah.
So here's the,
so you see the extension there in the middle.
Yep.
So that bought us enough time.
So that's the extending the dam.
Yep.
Yep.
And then we let it out. And, you know, cause we were concerned that we would lose the dam. And I remember that one of the engineers that had worked on the dam from the early part of the century was still alive.
Yeah.
And they interviewed him and they said, should we be worried about that dam? And he said, no, that dam is well built and you do not have to worry about that. And nobody thought another thing about it.
Soon as he said
nobody knew the guy, but
so there it is, the Oakley Miracle.
Yep.
Anyway, there's a great book on it that details the collaboration and there it is right there. The Oakley Miracle.
Well,
a flood cannot happen
flood
here.
Flood can't happen here. That's true. It can't.
Yeah.
But you know what about did again? In 2017, Snowmageddon here in Boise. And the record runoff that happened in 1984 was surpassed in 2017. Now, it didn't last as long because it was just a quick rain on snow event. But the inflow was higher in 2017 than it was in 2018, but it didn't last.
Do you think in today's world you're able to do what you did in 1984? Do you think we still have that?
I think you could in Oakley.
I think
and here. I mean, when you are faced with a common threat, people
pull together.
They pull together.
Yeah.
And they put it to aside their differences because, you know, there's differences in Oakley and they've cultivated those for 100 years. But, I mean, they put those issues aside.
And come together
for the common good. And so it was...
It's a great Idaho story.
It was a good Idaho story. But I do think that those same people, the kids of that generation here, and give them a common goal, they'll pull together.
What does it say? You know, one of the things that we talk a lot about in Idaho is our heritage.
Right.
Yeah. And, you know, I wasn't born here. I was born in Magny, Utah, which has a different heritage. Both of my grandparents worked at the copper mines as far back, great-grandparents too. But what about the Idaho heritage? What does that mean to you as a...
Well, when I was out campaigning, you know, the one thing that people would always come up and say to me is don't let all this new growth change who we are. Now, I don't know exactly what that means to everybody, but I know what it means to me. I don't want to wake up 10 years from now and wonder where my Idaho went. So I think that we've been somewhat unique here in that we've had the political backdrop or the landscape has been such where we can put Idaho values, which is hard work, living within your means, you know, not reliance on government, et cetera, and put those values into policy. And we've done that consistently for 30 plus years. And that hard work, that laying the foundation politically and economically in Idaho, I think is what we can point to for our success now. The quick growth that we're having now and the fast growth is based on because we've created something that people want to be a part of. And so that's going to give us some challenges, all this fast growth. Just because we're growing so fast doesn't mean they're going to give us more water.
Yeah.
Doesn't mean they're going to give us more lane miles. Doesn't mean they're going to give us more desks in the schools. I mean, we've got to do some planning here. And so that's what excites me about being the lieutenant governor and being involved in Idaho politics is we've got problems, you know, or we have, you know, not problems necessarily, opportunities, if you will, but we've got to, in order to keep, you know, no, our kids are going to be the keepers of the culture, not us. I mean, we're closer to not being around than they are. And so if we can have a situation and create an economic climate here where an Idaho kid can always get an Idaho job, then we'll keep the culture here. And, you know, on the one hand, we'll wash the other. You got to have a positive, vibrant business climate, but you also got to have a good education system that feeds into that workforce. And the one hand washes the other, one hand creates opportunity. Well,
and what I love about what you've done is we were already the least regulated state. I mean, good for business. It's just a great place to do business. Government get out of the way was kind of all the thing. And then you've got a lot of the natural heritage and resources people want to be here. We needed some investments in education, and you have been leading that effort.
We've done that.
Governor Little, and like launch. I mean, what a tremendous success! Can you imagine?
You know, dirty little secret here. We would have been tickled to death if 6,000 kids would have signed up.
Yeah,
and by the end of December, we're over 12,000, and the deadline is not even till April. Yeah. And you know, back when you were a senior in high school, you would have procrastinated till April.
All the way to the end.
And so would have I. And so there's going to be this another flush of numbers, and it surpassed our expectations by a long ways. Yeah. Now, it hasn't been funded yet, and that's another issue and whatnot. But
we're pulling it up here because I do think getting the information out there. So this is for any graduating seniors. It's Idaho Launch.
Yeah. 2024 seniors and on. Yeah.
2024 seniors and on. We love it with what we do because it's into in-demand jobs in Idaho. Right. And so you've got these Idaho kids, and you know the wages they're able to earn now in these jobs.
Yep.
They're livable wages.
With just a little bit more post high school education, they can get, as you say, into great jobs.
I it's amazing. It's amazing what's happened, and it wasn't easy, right? Right.
No, it only passed by one vote.
Passed by one vote,
Hopefully that everybody sticks. But I think that even some of the naysayers, when they see the demand, you know, of 12,000, they get to say no. If they don't fund this, they get to say no to 12,000 plus kids that flock to this because they weren't necessarily cut out for a 4-year baccalaureate degree. They just want to get a good job. They want to work with their hands, et cetera. And I was out in those high schools. I was in 30 plus high schools, and to see the lights come on, particularly in the alternative high schools, those kids, you know, they've been kicked around a little bit by life, and to see the lights come on, you're telling me that there's $8,000 available for me to get an education.
And I think there was a lesson learned on kind of go on, right? Go on for whatever reason, when go on kind of was the lingo.
Yeah.
All you talk to the high school kids and it was go on to college, go on to a 4-year degree, even though it was never said, it was go on to the next level.
Right.
But this seems to be so much more focused on those in demand jobs, those 2-year jobs, those apprenticeships that get people into these jobs that are in such demand right now. So it's a phenomenal thing.
Well, and I guess you were raised in a house. I was raised in a house where college was expected. So when we're out pitching how the value of education, we spoke about that in the context that we knew.
Yeah.
And a quick story on this. I was out at one of the high schools, one of the big high schools here in the Valley. And a mother came up to me after we pitched this. And she walked me out to the car and she said, I got 3 kids. All of them are in their 20s. And the 2 of them got their baccalaureate degrees. One's living with me in the basement. The other one hasn't quite found that good job yet. And the third one went to lineman school in CUNA. And she said, guess which one owns their own house?
The
lineman. And she said, and then she went on to gush of how this is exactly what, and would that have been available to her other kids and their peers.
Anyway. Well, and with technology, these jobs are technical now. They're using your hands. They're engaging. I do think in America, I mean, just with technology and what's happened, this move back to where you're using your hands and you're doing stuff and you're, I think kids love that too. If you can expose them, if you can give them line of sight early to a career path that they can earn a living and enjoy what they're doing.
Well, and they're, but see, they're ending up in those jobs anyway, because the go-on rate didn't change because the economy is growing. They end up in these jobs. But another quick example is I knew there are two kids worked at a fab plant, metal fab. One had all the one had come out of a welding program and had a stack of certificates. The other kid learned in the job. Then the fab plant closes. And guess which kid was able to get the next job the fastest? The one with the stack of credentials.
Yeah.
And he went right to the top of that new job. And just having that little extra of formal education means a lot to the next employer. And they, anyway, it's a great, Governor Little always calls it a game changer. He might've got that phrase from me, but it will be a game changer. This is going to change kids' lives.
It is a game changer. Hey, I do want to talk a little bit about the legislature. It's in session right now.
Yeah.
Some of the positives and challenges that are going through there. But before I do, you brought up Governor Little. How is it working with him? I know you're longtime friends. And
yeah, we knew each other from before either one of us were elected office, because we're both public land ranchers. We ranch on your public land, Tommy. And so to have that be a generational thing, there's always a political component to public land policy, because no never means no for more than 4 years. Yes never means yes for more than 4 years. So that we're always active in the National Public Lands Council. And we met actually in Washington, D.C., lobbying the issues in Congress. Mm. And so, yeah, so we get along very well. There's trust there. There's respect there. Scott and Sarah are very friendly with Brad and Teresa. And they're just good Idaho people, just solid folk. And so that's us. And then, of course, then we both end up in the state legislature. And then our paths, led us to where we are right now.
Appreciate your service. Let's talk about the session. Idaho politics are a little nutty, as usual.
Well, then they're in a process of a meltdown right now. And in fact, I was speaking yesterday and it took questions out of the audience and they said, has this ever happened before? And I said, it absolutely has. I've been there twice where JFAC was disbanded and they quit working, and once in 2006.
Okay, so let's get a little context to this. Okay. So JFAC is probably the most powerful committee.
Right.
I mean, it's the one that's the budget committee, and it's what decides how money's spent. And give us a little bit of background on how it historically is run and then what's going on this year.
All right, so JFAC is Joint Finance and Appropriations. So the Senate Finance and the House Appropriations meet jointly. Now, in many states, they have a Finance Committee and an Appropriations Committee, and then they both pass, for example, public school budgets. And they may not be exactly the same, and so they have to reconcile that. And conference, and so the United States Congress, that's all they do is conference, because the Senate bill never matches the House bill and vice versa. Now, in the 60s, they said in Idaho, we're not going to do it that way. It's inefficient. We want to be done. This is a part-time legislature. And so they, instead of having a conference committee at the end, they put the conference committee at the start. And so 10 House members and 10 senators meet in the joint committee, and they have special rules and all. And that's how we've done it. But when they get high-centered from time to time, because there's built-in friction between the House and the Senate, and then there's always friction within the House and within the Senate, then the system kind of grinds to a stop, and they're stopped right now. And so they'll get over it, but it's a great system, because it forces the House and Senate to come together on a bill or on a budget. And there's probably 80 plus budgets, so it's a powerful committee, but it's not supposed to be the policy committee. The other committees are the ones that set the policies and say, hey, JFAC, you got to fund this. And so then they're allocating scarce resources around all the various projects are all the various programs. So what you got this year was an attempt to not look at the statutes, pass bills that were, quote, maintenance budgets, and the phrase was keep the lights on and the doors open, but it didn't, but it left out many of the statutory requirements so that everybody could vote yes on a bill, but knowing full well that it didn't fund all the stuff, and then that they'd come in later and add the line items, and then everybody could get the pass for voting yes on the agency maintenance budget and vote no on all the stuff, and then go into this primary in May saying, well, look at me. I didn't grow government. I supported the bare bone stuff, and I didn't grow government. And that, and in today's political climate, that goes farther, they think, in a May primary than it does to just go do the work of the state. And you can tell that it kind of bugs.
But it's frustrating, right? I mean, it's time. It's you elect these folks to go and work together and figure out solutions, yeah. and not be political. Right.
Well, one other thing, I mean, we create this system that is resistant to manipulation.
Yeah.
And so you follow the rules. There's not one thing. There's not one corner that you can't back out of parliamentarily or through the rules. And when you try to cut corners or try to manipulate that, then the system kind of rebels. Huh. And so that's kind of where you're seeing.
So you think we get through it.
I do.
It's going to take some time.
Yeah.
So you said something. Everyone's up for reelection.
Yeah.
So typically you would want or see maybe a streamlined, you know, session so that people could get out and campaign. But this is kind of throwing a wrench. I've talked to a few people that are like, oh, this is.
Well, I mean, we've done it before. The longest session on record was in 2006, and they didn't get out of the session until May 11th. And then the primary was like May 21st. This year it's 21st. You know, so there's always this, well, it's an election year, so we got to get out of here. And that's used as a lever to, hey, just go along and let's get out of here. But these legislators are independent thinkers, and they go, well, wait a minute. I didn't come here to just rubber stamp something. I have ideas. I'm not going to get rolled. And they go, I'm out. I'm no. I don't like this. And so you're seeing government and civics at work here where everybody is on equal footing there, and they got to put together 36 votes in the House and 18 votes in the Senate, and the governor's got to think it's a good job. And when you start cutting corners in that process and thinking that everybody's just going to go along because they want to get home, the Idahoans say, no, I don't feel good about that, and I'm not voting for it. And so that's kind of what's going on.
Well, what are some of the challenges you see bill-wise coming through?
Well, I think there's a couple of big deals, big initiatives coming through. You know, in Idaho, we build our schools with property tax. But the Constitution says it's the legislature's responsibility to provide a general, uniform, thorough system of free common schools. And the courts have said, and that includes a safe school building. And so so this initiative that the governor brought forward in the state of the state is to have the state have an increased role in the funding and building of the schools and the repair and the maintenance of the facilities. And so basically they went to the, you know, Idaho's economy has slowed down a little bit, and we've lowered the tax rate, so we're collecting a little less revenue, but we're still doing very, very well. And so we basically asked the market, hey, market, if we give you $125 million every year for the next 10 years, how much money will you give us tomorrow morning? And the market said, we'll give you a little over $1 billion. And so that $1 billion is now proposed to be scattered around all the various different school districts and to be used for retiring debt, or fixing schools, or building new schools. So that will, and that's straight up property tax.
Can you do me a favor?
Yeah.
One of the things that has never made sense to me.
Yeah.
You have all these schools, you have 114.
Yeah.
It's like 114, 115 school districts. In fact, in some places in the state, like they're like within, you know, you can hit a 9-iron to the next school district, right?
Well, if you're good, you may need a driver.
I need a driver. but why not have some standardization of school buildings? Because I'll tell you, like within the industry, like you get, I love architects, but if you give architects an unlimited budget.
Absolutely.
And I love general contractors, but if you, you know, general contractors, if you go build, you know, the Taj Mahal, you make more than if you build, you know,
the cinder box.
They're not incentivized. So then these school districts get bonding or whatever. It would be so easy and efficient in the real world, right? If it wasn't government funding it, you would have, you'd have tiered of, hey, for this size of elementary and for this size of elementary, here are the prototypes. Now you can make a few changes to the prototypes, but we have studied how to build them efficiently. You would save, because I think what drives some people crazy about government spending is here's $1 billion to go
it's
do this
inefficient.
Stuff. Inefficient. You're going to take that $1 billion and you say, hey, if it was the private sector, like if it's our dollars that we're investing, I mean, there's when you go up and down this freeway and look at the buildings we built, these office buildings, they look very similar to each other. And the reason why is we figured out a way with our own money to build a nice building that people want to be in, but pencils, right?
Right.
It would be so easy.
Well, it is. And I think that you're seeing the start of that very process because now the state is involved in the building in Oakley.
Right.
And so
instead of,
it's going to start requiring. Yes,
I love that.
But on the other hand, if you go to and Kesha, is always a little ahead of the rest of the state. So we have a consolidated countywide school district. All of the, so Burley, Declo, Oakley, Raft River, it's all in the same district.
Makes so much sense.
But you go right across the county line to Kimberly, Hanson, Murtaugh.
They are their
own. You maybe not hit a driver that far, but within 8 miles, there are three school districts.
Oh, yeah.
And then you go to the rest of Twin Falls County, there's another 7 or 8. You come up to Kangen County, there's a dozen. I mean, it is inefficient as to administration. But there's
so think about this. Now those inefficient school districts get awarded money.
Yeah. State money. It's not local tax money.
But if there's not some way to help them, and it will help them, they're going to go out and find an architect and design a building, and they're going to fumble around and end up anyway. You'll figure this out.
We've built buildings in Kaja through the bonds. But when the top 15% of that money has to go to the architect.
Yeah.
Now I see, but you and I both are acquainted with an institution that has pretty much cookie cutter buildings.
Right.
And so, if you have an elementary school of this size, here's your plan.
Yeah.
If it's this size, here's your plan.
And here's some ad alternates that we found.
If you wanted to add alternates and you want to pay for them with local money, boom, go for it.
Oh, amen.
And
can you pull that off?
I think that we're in the process of
that. That'd be awesome. What are some challenges facing Idaho? Talked a little bit about growth. What else do you see from your seat? Idaho bigger challenges?
A couple. Number one, we still live in the arid west. We're going to have to take care of our water supplies. And, agriculture is still a big deal in the state of Idaho. And so that's going to drive a lot of the water, issues right up until we redistrict the state a couple more times. And the water issues will then be driven by the population centers. You're seeing that now in Utah. That the ag interests are secondary now to the urban suburban interests. So that's in our future, I think. We're gonna have to get along too.
I'm glad you brought that up.
We'll either live together as brothers or die together as fools. I think Martin Luther King said that. Mm. We're gonna have to figure out a way to get along. Now, Abraham Lincoln, one of his famous quotes, and it's an easy one because I can remember it. It was, I don't like that man, comma. I must get to know him better.
Mm.
So we have got to exercise the things that we all know. We gotta live the golden rule. We gotta treat our neighbors. Mm. That's what happened. I mean, we point to the miracle in Oakley is that they had a common goal, they had a problem, they solved it. We want, if we're going to keep the republic,
Yeah.
Like Benjamin Franklin said, you know, a republic, madam, if you can keep it. If we're going to keep the republic, we're going to have to be engaged citizens. But we're going to have to get along, and we're going to have to work on common problems. And my opinion can't trump yours, and vice versa. And we're just going to have to figure out a way.
You know what's always, and I know you'll be able to speak to this. If you and I pick a policy and we disagree on it, and we sit down and we start talking about it, very quickly we'll realize we're really much closer than we thought we'd be. And almost any policy or issue, if we start talking and we get in a room together, we're going to come together. What happens is people don't want to talk about it. Right. And in today's world, there's sometimes a breed of politician that just wants to, they're there for entertainment. They're there for sensationalizing headlines. They're not really there to solve problems. And that, I think in today's world where everything's instantaneous and it's always a headline, that's going to be a problem. But hopefully there's enough people that are there for the right reasons. I know the legislature, and I'm probably the worst at this. I mean, I always say, hey, you know, one of the old ER adages of medicine, yeah, first do no harm, right? But they come to, you come to town and they, what is it, 180 to 200 new bills? How many new bills get passed every year?
Well, Matthew? Passed, I don't know. There's probably 400 or 500 introduced.
There's probably 400 or 500, but I think it's a lot. I mean, it's a couple hundred new bills every year. So first do no harm. And I'm always kind of, why are we doing this or messing with it? But when you meet individual legislators that you have for years, they're really good people,
right,
that care deeply about this state, that are elected for good reasons. Yeah. And a lot of them are great people. Now, I think there's always a few knuckleheads. We know that. But most of the time, people want to do what's right.
Well, that's true. And you and I have been labeled with the moniker of being a wonk.
Yeah.
Because we work the details.
Talk policy, right?
Yeah, we go right to policy. Governor Little is that way. Yeah. And so the political handlers always say, you can't explain it that way. Nobody, you're going too deep in a subject. You got to stay at 10,000 feet. And that always bugs me.
Why do you want to talk about solutions and how to fix things? You just need political and make a point.
But we got into politics because we saw a problem and we wanted to, and we figured there was a better way. And so if you're going to trust me enough to send me to Boise to represent your interest, I believe that you expect me to know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
And if we get all of that in one room, if I get to know what you got to have and what you absolutely won't have, we lay both our hands on the table. From those cards, we can make a better hand than either one of us had to begin with and still respect your boundaries.
I'm going to tell, so last summer, Mike Boren, my really good friend, he hosts a party at his ranch every summer. And this summer he had Mad Dog Mattis there. Okay. And it was amazing because I've read his books and he's one of my heroes, and I was so excited to go to this thing. And he didn't want to give a speech. He wanted to sit in front and just take questions. So Mike had it all set up where he sat up front and for 2 hours just took questions. And Scott, it was one of the highlights of my life listening to someone with that experience.
Right.
And he told stories about being in these situations around the world that were just harrowing and just that's crazy.
Well, that's, I mean, we don't want our generals just to phone it in. we want them to know exactly what they're talking about and to be masters of the basics. He's got
these one-liners. Yeah. He is just truly, he's just a badass, right?
Yeah.
That's him. Yeah. So he's asked at the end of this, so 2 hours of these harrowing stories, what is the biggest threat to America right now, mm-hmm, internationally? And after 2 hours of it, you're thinking, okay, is he going to say Russia? Is he going to say China? Is he going to say North Korea? Because he's told stories about all these. And he sits back in his chair and he said, the biggest threat to America comes from within. Right. He said, if we do not figure out a way to come together as Americans, that's our problem. And he had this impassioned speech. Someone sitting right back to me in the back you know, he'd made a couple comments and he raised his hand and stood up and he says, General Mattis, I don't believe in that. I believe in my position, mm-hmm, and I think all these other people are wrong and I don't agree with you. And he said, how do we ever get two people that disagree so wildly on social issues or other things? And I wondered what Mattis would say, yeah. right? And you know what he said? He said, I don't have the answer, but I would take those two people and I would put them in a room and I would walk away and let them just sit and get to know each other and talk and find any way that they can come together. It was a great moment of wisdom for me because I thought, we do have challenges, but it's got to be through coming together as Americans. It's got to be, what do we have in common? I mean, if you take someone in, I've got one of my really good friends who's an ER doctor. His wife grew up in San Francisco. She's a fourth generation Chinese American from San Francisco who didn't get out of Chinatown until she went to Berkeley to school. If I look at her view of America, it is going to be different than the Bedke,
absolutely,
1863 moving to Oakley. Taylor Sheridan needs to make a movie about the Oakleys, but
let's just keep it in Montana. I've had so many people ask me, "Is that how it is where you?" I said, "Well, yeah. Other than we all go to church and we don't kill each other."
Come on, you and Sarah could be the Faith Hill and Tim McGraw the next season.
I don't know. Sarah could, I could.
Anyway, yeah. I do think it's about coming together and figuring this out.
Yeah. Well,
one more question. Okay. Is the Freedom Foundation they've had a lot of turnover.
Yeah.
Wayne's gone. A few people are gone. I mean, it seems like they're...
Well, the Freedom Foundation fills a vacuum that exists out there. People are concerned about their country. They're concerned about their state. And they were able to dumb it down in a way that keeps the polarization. It's the Freedom Foundation is first and foremost a business.
It's an entertainment business,
and they've got to keep and it lives and dies on donations.
Yep.
And so if they're not seen as moving,
so if I can scare you, if I can sensationalize, if I can do whatever, you're going to donate to me because I'm going to tell you that I'm going to go do this thing. But it seems like maybe it's the Mountain States Policy Institute coming in. I don't know what it is, but it seems like they've lost a little steam. Do you feel that in the legislature?
I do. That ebbs and flows, and we'll see what happens.
I don't even know who listens to this podcast, but if they're going after Ron Nate to be their guy,
yeah,
well, hey, that's you're dipping to the bottom of the barrel, Lieutenant Governor.
I've worked, served in the legislature with Nate.
Well, couple more questions. We're running out. We could do this all day.
We could. There's a quick on back to your point with Mad Dog. See, we always assume that today is the most divisive, or our politics today are the most divisive they've ever been. But right after we won the Revolutionary War and all these colonies, they couldn't ever borrow money from Europe to finance that war collectively. They did it individually. And then when the war was over, they assumed that all 13 would help pay it off. And all 13 didn't want to do it. And so George Washington was concerned that they would be, laughingstock of Europe. They were going to default and they were going to fulfill, everything that England said bad about them. And so they convened that convention in 1787 in Philadelphia, and they invited 74 delegates. Do you know how many showed up? 55. Samuel Adams, Patrick Henry, Thomas Jefferson. These were all invited delegates. They didn't come because they had something else to do or they didn't want to do it. They smelt the rat in Philadelphia, some of the famous quotes. 55 eventually showed up. They got a quorum by the second week. And then 13 of the 55 got mad and left, leaving 42 that stayed all summer long to hammer out the Constitution. And at the end, only 39 of the 42 would even sign the document. And that document has become the world acknowledged world best governing document. And 19 to begin with had something better to do. 13 got mad and left. 3 disagreed and wouldn't sign it. And 39 ended up signing the world's greatest governing document. So, we were able to call each other names quicker because we've got cell phones and that. But the founding fathers were more like feuding cousins at best, and they were able to bring it together and do it. And so, you know, the human problems are still the same. We can speed up, you know, everything in this digital age, but they didn't get along. But they did sit down in a room, and of course, they what they do with the big issue of the day was they kicked that can down the road 50 years. They didn't take up slavery in the Constitutional Convention. And whether they should or shouldn't, or whether that's why some of them left or wouldn't sign, I don't know. But
that's a great point.
We're able to do this if we just will. And that locking people in a room and making them come out, I mean, that was a tactic that I used as speaker. You're going to get the people in here, and we're not going to run your bill, and we're not going to run your bill. You guys find something you can agree on, and we'll run that. And then we'll see how it works for a year. And if we got to change it, we'll change it. And we just do what we do back home in the legislative setting. And I think that's part of the secret sauce of Idaho is you had this common sense guys that needed to get home by March. And they put them together. Now, there's exceptions and there's, you know, I get it. I'm painting too broad of a brush here. But eventually, in Idaho, we get around to doing the right thing.
Yeah.
And I think we've got to get back to that. And if we quit talking to each other, we're not. If we're scared to, if we can't hold up our end of an argument, or if we're not, we don't know the issues well enough, then we avoid the conversation because I'll look stupid soon in the conversation because I don't know what I'm talking about. So I need people that know the issues to the, you know, to the base of them. And then we can come in and do something that everybody can agree on. Will everybody like it? No, but they can tolerate it, and it's a move forward. And that's what it's going to take.
Last question. Okay. I've been around you with your kids, your grandkids.
Yeah.
I think you're one of the most genuine, tried and true Idahoans I've ever known, and you're a great example to a lot of people. What does this country mean to you? What does Idaho mean to you, Lieutenant Governor?
Wow. On some level, I mean, you're tugging at my emotional reason for being here. The United States of America and its founding, I believe, is a product of divine help. And I'm lucky enough to live in Idaho. I think it's the best place to live and to work and to raise a family. It's given the Bedke family no help, just stayed out of the way and gave them an opportunity to go do and prosper. That's what motivates me. I've got 16 grandkids. Sounds like an old guy now. But, I mean, if we look at everything we do through the eyes of what's going to be good for them, then we're not going to go too far wrong. And I want them to have the same opportunities. Some of them, you know, be on the ranch. Some of them, you know, it's just not that big, and they don't want to be on the ranch. But we want them to get a good education. And we want there to be a job in Idaho commensurate to the level of education. I've got master's degree kids and all like that, and I want them to not have to leave the state to get a job that pays them on a level commensurate to that master's degree. I want them to find it here in Idaho. And luckily, they have. They've been gone for 10, 15 years, and they've been able to move back because our economy has grown that much. Now, that's not the end of my world if I'm not in politics. I've got a really good situation to go back into. And I think that allows me to be very candid. I like being the lieutenant governor. As a speaker, I always had to measure everything I said, because the caucus is listening, and I didn't want to create myself problems in this process that I described earlier. And so but now, you know, I can be a lot more candid. I can call a spade a lot closer to a spade now than I used to be able to. And so that is invigorating on some level, is just to go out and promote Idaho, because we got something really great here, and try to get people to, we appeal to their better angels and just let's go do it. They know, I believe everybody knows what the difference between right and wrong is at a personal level. And we just got to appeal to them to do the best thing. Because, well, here's another thing that I've learned out on the campaign trail, whether I'm talking to far left or far right. The one thing that those parents and grandparents want is their kids to be well-educated. That is an issue that can bring us together in Idaho. It does, like I say, it doesn't matter whether you're on way over here or way over there. They know that it's that their kids and their grandkids are going to be better off if they have more education rather than less. And that gives us, you know, so if the room gets wild, that's the high ground that I can go to and defend in the most rancorous situation.
Well, you're a great example to us. Thank you for coming on. Good luck with the rest of the session. And thanks for all you do.
Well, I'm just the lieutenant governor now. I'm not down in the middle. I'm not managing the egos, not managing the personalities. I'm just presiding in the Senate.
Thank you very much for all your service.
You're welcome, Tommy.
All right.